to the final presentation of 2014. This is number 52. And in the series entitled Parayana, we've been looking at a future transform that is happening as we speak to the civilization that we have inherited and have come to realize again as every node in the time rhythm, very, very vast and long, of civilization comes to recognize is that time is an energy. And when a time form has run its course, its energy is depleting rapidly. And the civilized response to this has always been, we need to renew the energy in a new form, a new time form. And so the colloquial usage of the last generation, or a little before, is that we are in a new age. And styling it as an age, oddly enough, gives it a regressive quality that we've been exploring. It goes back to a time where the Roman Empire was formed, because a previous time form had run out and a new age was dawning, and the new age was commandeered, hijacked by the Roman Empire. In our time, the hijacking is by a world order empire, and it has a subterranean quality to it that this also involves aliens. In the previous time form, running out of energy, running out of time, needing a renewal of a new age, the quality was that we have a power that has a divine source, and that the divine source is wrapped in an archetype of actuality in time, in civilization, and that is that there is a divine king, a leader of mankind's structures of society, of political structure, of life and understanding, an arbiter of rituals, a generator of the correct myths, and that mythic experience with its language, its images, its feelings, are all able to be integrally commandeered and tied with the knots of a time form, which allows for exact calculation. And it reminds one of the ancient Peruvian form of keeping time measurements, that of the quipu. The quipu was a cord that was knotted, and for each segment of a time form happening, one would tie a knot. And so the quipu was something that could be consulted by looking or even by touch, that you could keep track of where everything was, not just in its place, but it's in its place in its time signature. And we have something akin to that now, in that the understanding comes to be integrated and then tied in a knot so it will stay. And this was done in the Roman Empire with its new age, in the time of Augustus Caesar, and even before, in the time of Abraham, some 2,000 years before Augustus Caesar, and 2,000 years before Abraham in the time of Adam and Eve. And so this whole heritage of a massive cluster and complex of knots on every trajectory, every vector that is of possible value in civilization has now been brought together, bundled, as it were, and that all of this has been put into a cyclic, circling, encircling quality called a circuit now, so that the power will flow and the switch will turn on because it is cued to that dynamic. You're plugged in. This haunts, especially at the very end of a time form, not a time, not an age, but a time form, which is quite real in a strategic enormity that takes vision in order to behold it, and takes a sense of history in order to understand it. And that vision, as we've been exploring again and again, becomes something that the beholder, patiently in learning to look within vision, rather than to look at what is being given, what is being represented, what is being instructed, following the complications to the knot, to the integral only, limited. This is how everything works and stays together because it works by staying where it's put. The knots, to those in vision, are obstructive, false puzzlings. They are dividing everything into jigsawed pieces that will fit into that picture, but that picture is indeed something artificial, and the most artificial signature that one could come up in terms of a mythic experience is that it is a mask, not someone. And not only a mask hiding the someoneness, but a mask that is geared to represent things and their actions, feelings, and our source of nutrition, so that there are masks of foods. One can do a watermelon mask. One can do a grape mask, etc. Or there are masks of feeling. You can have the happy and tragic of a Greek drama, etc. And in the learning civilization program that we have, at last, long last, masks of food and masks of feeling interface together, back to back, so that the imaginative wearer of that pair of masks is able to establish that they are a presence rather than the source of either or even of both those masks. That one is not defined by what you eat or what you feel, though to some great extent it helps gives a definition in terms of identity. And it is the identity which is the knot formed by the conviction that identification is delimiting the context so that it becomes exact. And one can then have an identification which is more and more accurate in all of the terms of identity, and that the Uber identification is that I am I. A equals A, and that for sure. This quality of identity is extremely difficult, and one of the great books of the 1960s, about now two generations ago, was by a man named Franz Fanon, and it was Black Skins, White Masks. And it was about the Caribbean blacks who were African, wearing the masks largely of French or British or Dutch or whatever colonial, Spanish, whatever powers had come in as colonial powers and had then established that this island is thus and so, and that it must be thus and so. And one of the archetypal islands in the Caribbean that had this was Haiti, French, one of the prizes of Napoleon in his world empire building. Franz Fanon's teacher was a man who was born on Martinique, and his name was Ami Césaire. And he lived to be almost 95 years old, born in 1913, and passed away in 2008. Ami Césaire is one of the influences on a still living, very great poet. His name is Will Alexander, and he's born, raised, bred, roams still in Los Angeles, but has resonances increasingly in other parts of the world, but has a literary heritage that has a great deal of the Ami Césaire surrealist quality, which, though born in Martinique, became extremely talented as a young man and went to Paris to go to a lycée, to school, and eventually worked his way up, so that he became quite a significant figure. And by the time that he was in 1935, he was able to pass the exams to go to the École Normale Supérieure, and there he met a fellow Afro, having to wear a mask, but a mask from West Africa, Leopold Senghor. And the two of them and a third friend formed a publication, a magazine. And it was French, en français, and it was L'étudiant noir, the black student. Within a very short time, César began a very long poem that was not to be finished until the late 1930s, 1939, but not really published because publishers refused to publish it until 1947. And its title and translation in English is A Return to the New World. And it is this quality of the ambiguities of Caribbean life and culture in the New World. And he largely refined it because he finally married his lifelong love his best friend, his shared presence person, Suzanne Roussy, in 1937, and they moved back to Martinique in 1939, about that time, with their young son. And it was there that they formed the new literary publication, Tropiques. And they were out to show that there was a much more legitimate identity for them, because they could take off not only the colonial mask, but they could take off the white mask as well, the European style of not just colonizing a place, but of colonizing a race. And that this extended in a very surreal mode, that once one was able to transcend the limitations of a place and of a race, you had a leg up on being able then to disinvolve yourself in the corrupt involvement, the forced involvements in all kinds of deceptions. And so one became aware that you are being lied to in every which way. And thus, it gave a new quality of understanding that freedom is something which is scalar. And to seek to find that, one of the qualities that Césaire took up was to write poetry as well as plays, in addition to his teaching, where he understood this is really education not to fit in, not to have this or that aspect of this or that identification, but that somehow there was a real identity that was actually surreal in terms of the world that was in swirl of manipulation. Césaire was extremely powerful in his influence on Will Alexander, who at the same time, being born and raised in South Central LA and at home on the vast network of streets of Los Angeles, where there is no holding colonization at all. Hardly anyone out of 16 million people would think of Sepulveda Boulevard as being the old fence line of the Sepulveda Ranch, running from Palos Verdes into the San Fernando Valley. One rancho, one family complex. Los Angeles does not have a traction with almost all of the false identities. And as a consequence, it's unlike almost any city in the world now, but is very like a city that was problematically the greatest city of the ancient classical world, and that city was Alexandria in Egypt, which was Egyptian, but founded under a Macedonian Greek, not even Athenian Greek, but Macedonian, which is really in what we would call today closer to what Yugoslavia was. But it also had elements of Judaism heavily involved. It had trading routes that reached all the way from India to Ireland and through the Straits of Gibraltar, following the old Phoenician routes all the way down the coast of Africa and up the coast of what is today Portugal and Spain, and into the Black Sea and into the stretches of the Red Sea, down into Africa, especially because for 5,000 years, the high civilization of Egypt was African. African to the extent that the most powerful of the early influences in the pharaonic line was a pharaoh named Djoser, who was a black African Egyptian pharaoh, and whose right-hand man was not only his personal physician, but his royal architect, Imhotep, also a black African. So that you had this quality where the deepest roots of classical Alexandria were Egyptian. So much so that the Alexandrian dynasty, the Ptolemies, heavily styled themselves to look like ancient Egyptian pharaohs. And so this quality of a black African root to the Alexandrian, almost colloquially a polyglot world civilization, a swirl, but it was a swirl with a Greek Hellenistic spoon, not just Greek, but Jewish Greek, Hellenistic. And also what it was stirring was a stew that was heated by Africa, by the energy of Africa. And one can see in Djoser his architect Imhotep together, like the physician artist of the wizardry of eventually millennia later, a Merlin. Djoser was like millennia later, incognate with a Merlin, King Arthur. He was the stylizer of the way in which a symbolic form archetypally became the high water identifying identity of Egypt, and that is the pyramid. It is Djoser and Imhotep that bring the black African quality into Egypt so that the true pyramid occurs for the first time through the bent pyramid that really didn't work, that was based on just using the stack of the step pyramid, to finally refining and understanding that there was an archetypal geometry going on here. And with the red pyramid, the first true pyramid at Giza, nearby in Saqqara, that whole region, beginning with Saqqara and Djoser and Imhotep, and then moving on very rapidly after that in the Old Kingdom to the pyramids of Cheops and Khafre and Mycerinus. And one began to understand that here the quality was that reaching from earth into the heavens, and that the constellation of Orion, with the belt of Orion being the great pyramids, and one began to have the sense that there was something here, that there was indeed a hidden identification and identity, really alien to the false cultures that were developed exclusively in trying to dominate and to limit the world of our, quote, normal surroundings. All of this came to a head in the 1930s, 1940s with Aimé Césaire as an influence on Will Alexander's work, and one of the great collections of his several dozen volumes now, is inside the Earthquake Palace with a cover by Will. He is also a great artist and musical composer, as well as a poet, a playwright, and a prose writer. Four plays inside the Earthquake Palace, where the two protagonists talk in the country, little country area of Montserrat, just before a volcanic eruption would devastate that area. One of the protagonists is named Giotto, the other Raphael, always referred to by his last name, Locano, in the play. And there is this interchange between them that eventually teases out a peculiar quality. Act one of five, rumbling noises, slight shaking of table and two chairs. Giotto and Locato are seating across from one another, intently conversing, sipping from glasses of spiced rum under falling cinder and orange-red lights. Giotto looking down at his folded hands, even if I perish by inhaling the sulfurs, I'll be illuminate in defeat. I've felt I've escaped the lists, Mr. Locato. They're cold and brazen, and until now I've always sought the safety of lists. Locato staring at Giotto intently. So, you've come to Montserrat as some form of liberty, some test of nerves to photograph extinction, and goes on from there. And the two begin to discover that they are unalike, though understanding what Franz Fanon had come to understand from Césaire's teaching, that black skins in white masks, that there are many masks that are going on. It's not simple whatsoever. And that the skins have a whole scalar of tones. And that this quality of influence on Will Alexander and on the world. Césaire's famous for coining the word negritude, that there is a subtle, poetic, kaleidoscopic insight, quality that the African primal origins of a species still has a current. There is a wonderful collection of early books of poems, Kaleidoscopic Omniscience, that includes a number of his early volumes, one of them almost unavailable now, is Asia and Haiti, and not a part of it. His very first book of poems came out in 1987, Vertical Rainbow Climber. And Asia and Haiti came out just a little later and has a tremendous advance in the ability to give a quality of exploring into not just the unknown, not even just the surreal, but to a vastness of poetic that is not identifiable, but is discoverable, as long as one eschews settling into identities and identifications that are almost generically misleading and corrupting. This requires something beyond the surreal and another deep influence on Will's work is the high Vajrayana, personified in a book that came out. Its title is a collection of essays by Jeffrey Hopkins. And it was meaning Meditation on Emptiness, published by Wisdom Publications in London. And many pages, six long sections, not just chapters, on the way in which there is a subtle development in the Vajrayana, in the diamond path, that shows again and again that the deception of identity, of identification, is endemic to a quality not just of a culture or of a time period or of a space place, but endemic into the very scalars and complexities that require a squeezing of that fruit of the center of one's self and freeing the juices from that fruit to flow into new possibilities, new ways of being. One of the great beginnings in Asia and Haiti, Asia with Jeffrey Hopkins in the Vajrayana, Haiti with Césaire, with the, his Martinique confrères, and the very beginning of the Haiti. There's a quotation from Maya Deren's great work on she did a wonderful work on the origins and meaning of voodoo and so forth. These undistinguished dead become known as that anonymous heritage, les morts, the dead. We, bubonic, with blackened, altering transmissives, with burning nerve links and schisms, twisted in piercing soils, in dark prematurity and rage. We are dead. We, the pressure and the cyclone of Haiti. Savage with usurpation, with claustrophobia by scarab, by blood loss and groaning. We who've taken spikes from our entrails, from suns we've had exploded in our nostrils, we who were spawned in harassment, in catastrophic silicate meanderings, in acidic neutral complexity. This quality of emergence at the end of a whole time form, not just the end of an age, which is a Roman Empire stylization. You talk about colonialism. It's still alive. You can check on your Al Jazeera channel of your TV today. They have a whole series on the battles that Pope Francis is fighting with his own structure in the Vatican. He refuses to live in the Vatican. He lives in a hotel room. He will not take the royal pontifical car. He drives with a driver in some old car, a man of the people, who says the entire curia, that selective body, have become manipulators and are corrupt and have been for generations. They own, just in the city of Rome, 24,000 buildings. The rental they get is close to $900 million each year. All of that is dwarfed by the take from the United States is $172 billion a year. Worldwide, they have 22,000 cathedrals and chapels. It is a quality of surreality that not just boggles the imagination, it gags and asphyxiates the very identifications that are delimited by laws, by courts, by police, by military, by design, by inculcation, by emphasis, by education. One of the great Vajrayana figures of about 600 years ago was Tsongkhapa. And Tsongkhapa developed a whole ecology of learning the way of liberation into freedom and founded what became the Gelugpa sect of the Vajrayana, headed by the Dalai Lama. Our current Dalai Lama, for whom Jeffrey Hopkins was the translator for several decades, organized conferences for him where one could have collections like Kindness, Clarity and Insight, the Dalai Lama at Harvard, etc. This Dalai Lama says that he is the last, that is that lineage is coming to an end with him. He's going to be 80 this year, 2015. How does a bodhisattva have a lineage that comes to an end? Let's take a break. Let's come back to our exploring of the ancient alive, not in the present, but in the presence. When you exhume present out of a time form, you get a continuum. There is no present. And what distributes throughout that time form's energy is presence. The closest angel in heaven to God is the angel of the presence. We have come to understand that that's a shared presence, and that angel is distributable to all ever. This is a painting done on Hollywood Boulevard over many years by an African-American named Joseph. And Joseph was the head book buyer for Book City, a huge used bookstore. They had a branch in North Hollywood as well, in the San Fernando Valley. But the Hollywood Boulevard Book City was the used bookstore on the scale that the original great Pickwick was for new books. And Joseph was the head book buyer for a whole generation of used books on every conceivable subject in the world and beyond. On Hollywood Boulevard, you had to cover a lot of beyond, along with the world in all of its kaleidoscope. The title of this painting is Gabriel's High C. For the end of a time form and the beginning of a time form, Gabriel from heaven to us direct blows his trumpet. He blows not a note, but he blows a jazz riff that you can only hear if you can hear jazz that takes blues and puts it into a new rhythm. And that new rhythm in blues ain't rock and roll. It's soul music. It's that quality that you find in the wonderful Black American music that the lyrics roll in a new way. And one of the great protagonists of that was Chuck Berry. One of the most popular of his songs with the Beatles was Johnny B. Good. He can play a guitar just like a ring in a bell. Go, go, Johnny, go. But for those of us who were alert kaleidoscopically in the 1950s, his song Roll Over Beethoven, Tell Tchaikovsky the News, they're rocking in two by two. You reel and bop and move it over, and it's that quality that is there in Joseph's life. He was the only person on Hollywood Boulevard who understood the mad goddess of complexity. His girlfriend, who went by the ancient Egyptian name of Nefertiti. There wasn't anyone who knew her real name. And she was the reincarnation of Nefertiti. And she insisted that Joseph was really that figure who was anciently the quality of her mate, and that all he had to do was to recognize his great archetypal significance. She was disturbed when he gave me the painting of Gabriel's High Seed. I ran a bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard from 1976 through 1981, and then went back to full-time being a teacher of wisdom. Will Alexander is one of those great figures for whom he understands the ancient archetypal origins, but understands that they are coursing through presence into a kaleidoscopic future. The very title, Kaleidoscopic Omniscience. The very sense of a vertical rainbow climber. The quality, and this slender volume, Exobiology as Goddess, with one of his paintings as a cover. Mid-poetic. No. And I am not speaking for the quest for dialectical frondage, but movement which sweeps across a narrow wall of flux, across foundational pathology, yet spinning above a garish vulture's milk. One thinks of fevers, of drawls, of quiescence, of burnings. Then the nerves, the chance. The quaking motor flows. My hearing focused upon songs about thirstless perennial doves, about the listless erasers of panic, like a tragic mystical salt within an incandescent bravery. And such bravery is the color of rhizomes and multiples, much like a splintered nebula is food. Her phonation flies throughout the high refractive index of diamonds, with their separate flares, with their special carbon ideals, become the motion in which sound floats, wafting above molten flowing in minus geras. This, by the way, is not Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, but this is an area in Brazil where all the great crystals come from. My lovely wife, Nisa, has a lot of experience in Brazil and has a great sense of crystals and that whole appreciation that there are special areas on the earth, not just for gold and silver and platinum, but for the jewels of nature, the crystals. Joseph's painting of Gabriel's High Sea is a crystal that has its facets cut by not just years, but whole generations of remembrance and insight going back before civilization, before culture became Homo sapiens sapiens. We were a species that was largely African. Joseph's gray beard and demeanor and everything was timeless in the sense that he could size a book up out of boxes and boxes of books and right away affix a price to it and have it carted off and put on a shelf, and did this for a generation. Hundreds of thousands of books had that ability, could hear Gabriel's High Sea because something was ending. It's all over. And something was seething to emerge like a volcanic sap coming out to be put into a distillation so its various sugars would give something like the sap from a maple tree being able to put into all kinds of forms, from pancakes to little candies to just the sense that one now could have something that had the tone that hadn't been seen before. About the time that Caesar passed away in 2008, a whole bundle of ingenuity and talent was happening at the University of Texas Press, which had published a volume in the year 2000, the millennium, the aeon. Betty Dijon Maedor, her book, Inanna, Lady of Largest Heart, about Inanna, the most primordial goddess in world literature, that established world literature, literally, not just figuratively, by Enhe Duwana, the head priestess of the Temple of Nana in Kishgagal, in Ur, and around 2300 BC. She was able to write the literary holding of the mythology of Inanna, the great goddess, the exobiology of, not just of, but as goddess, and to live that life and to reach out to all of the various city-states with their temples in Sumeria, in that southern part of Mesopotamia, spread out along the Euphrates, into the Persian Gulf, into the Tigris, and to be able to put into a poetic each of the gods and goddesses, the divinities of that temple, of that city, and to do this again and again until she had made a necklace of jewels, of poetic jewels, known as the temple hymns, that takes the light of Inanna, the exobiology of the goddess. She's bringing into play something which was there that lit the moon in all of its phases, that whole lunar cycle that, yes, this is how it is, and is related to the sun with its diurnal being thus and so. Yes, it can be obscured by clouds. It's the clouds obscuring, not the sun going out or dampening. And so the moon and the sun, the publishing house of Asia and Haiti, in fact, is Sun and Moon Press in Los Angeles. One sees in all the Tibetan tankas the sun and the moon in the upper angles. And this quality of Betty DeJong Mador, in this epical book of 2000, University of Texas Press, followed it up in 2009, just months after, in fact, it was being printed when Césaire passed away in April. His birthday was in June. He would have been 95 years old. She translates the temple hymns, the quality that is exceptional in this is how she begins. The first temple hymn, even though she's the high priestess at Ur, enormously talented, having the background and the backing of her father, Sargon of Akkad, who founded the entire dynasty, who took the power out of the millennial hands of the Sumerians and put it into a North Semitic forming, reforming, recalibration of Akkadia. Its location still has never been exactly found. Many things are still hidden, soon to come out, not quite yet. The first to found what we would today call a grand world scale international empire stretching from the Cyprus island in the Mediterranean to the Indus River watershed in India. 4,400 years ago. 4,400 years ago. 4,000 years before Shakespeare was established. She did not choose Ur, where she was the high priestess. She chose the most ancient city of Sumeria, where it began to have a god mythology centered on a temple area, which then would be next to the palace, and that the link of palace and temple together is that kind of primordial barbell by which the exercise of empire is maintained and kept. She went to the temple of Enki at Eridu. Translated by Betty Dejong Meador, just a few lines. Before any Diwana could fix the order of her collection of temple hymns, she had to make a decision which one to begin with. And she has this quality which comes through. Abzu, your hymns praise creation's elements, your grand surrounding wall unequaled, and the chamber where the god lives, whose dining hall lets no light enter truly from wall to wall. Your firm anchored house has a purity beyond measure. O crowned Eridu, shining crown, sworn by your prince, the great prince, the Sabu priest makes the pure plants grow. Where your watery home hits the great below, and voices pour out to Utu, revered shrine stretching towards heaven. They carry bread from the oven to eat, the oven brimming over, rivals the holy chamber. Words of your prince, prince of heaven and earth, cannot be altered. The creator, the wise one, decreed. Lord Nudimud, the blood maker, O Enger, has built this house on your radiant site and placed his seat upon your dais. Bread and wine, 4,300 years ago, in a North Semitic Akkadian language, still written in cuneiform, but to be the textbook for writing in cuneiform for the next 1,000 years. She was the Homer before there was a Homer. Homer, who was a contemporary of King David, who was the first to write an elegant poetic Hebrew, the Psalms. And Homer, the first to write an elegant written Greek, not only the Iliad and the Odyssey, but the Homeric hymns, hymns to Hermes, to Apollo, and so forth. They're contemporaries. They're millennial. In between two great ages, like a pivot, one that great age that some 400 years after Eni Diwana came a visionary in Ur, a young man named Abram, who later, after visionary transform, in carrying out a journey, a pilgrimage to somewhere knew a promised land that the vision delivered, he became Abraham. Born about 2000 BC. Almost all of the dating that one finds is wrong. Unless you know the rhythm of the time forms, civilization does not ring like a bell. The language of a poetic falls into a dissonant quality that one can get used to, but a real harmonic has a penetration into the invisible, where there is no allegorical limit any longer. And reality is more astounding than any surreality could chaotically attempt. This quality comes into play in our time. One of the wonderful developments about the time that Bedore was doing her Ene Diwana, humming the blues inspired by Ene Diwana's songs to Inanna, published in Oregon. She has a very interesting take. The first lines of the first little blues poetic, Sister. Sometimes I think I ought to call you the Queen of the May, the way you toss light like yellow dandelions out of a basket here and there, or maybe I should call you God, the way you've wrapped the laws of heaven and earth around your waist, like a belt, the way you skim over chaos like a quicksilver river. But I call you Sister, because you're like the rest of us, opening like a pale morning, swelling like a storm, clutching the torch of longing to your breast until you feel life at your throat, until you're all dressed up in flames. Sweet Sister, you know it all. A woman's desire is deep, and you're the measure of it. Cass Douglas. There are qualities of the emergence of Inanna. Here's a cover with Inanna and her flowing dress, and the royal line of Sargon standing with his oblation to her and her dance of reality. It is a quality that is emerging because one has, for the first time, an understanding that the last generation, the last 20, 25 years, has seen a surging of resonance in a large scalar harmonic around figures that were for a long time understood by just a handful. So few that even saying esoteric would be billboarding it. Up until about 25 years ago, you could count on your fingers the books on Ibn Arabi, the greatest Islamic poetic seer of all time. There have been about 50 books published on or translations of various works of his in the last 25 years. A surge of Ene Diwana studies, not just princess, priestess, poet, but the whole realization that there is a new past that presence makes a continuum with the future when we are sharing the presence. That the present moment is the archetypal form of lying about time, about the fact that it is a first dimension, that it brings dimensions into play, and that that play is part of the dance of the real. This is a quality that is stifled, and when it becomes stifled, it becomes a real threat to the recently acquired empire, the world empire, just like now. A new world order is threatened because its so-called sourcing money, power, military, aliens even. All of this is brought not only into question, not only into doubt, but being evaporated into irrelevance quickly. Like the sun rising evaporates the dew and brings the new day. In those situations, there is always some seer who has been given a feminine wisdom in a masculine tone of exploration, so that there is an incredible balance going on, whose language then has a particular kind of poetic flow of presence, because it came by being raised, refined again and again by shared presencing. And in the last time form major node, I call them carrier waves, the figure who said the end has come in the grandest way at the time. That grand way was called apocalypse. Saint John in Ephesus, having been born to a mother named Salome, who was the oldest sister of Jesus, who was raised by his older brother James, about 10 years older, until he was 12. And at the Last Supper, it was nephew to uncle, young John to Jesus. Am I the betrayer you're fingering out now? Lay his head on his chest, because he was a beloved nephew, was special. Having been raised by not only the mother Salome, born in Alexandria, where the family was at the time, with the infant Jesus until he was 5, Saint John grew to be a massive threat to the new power maturation of the Roman emperors who had replaced the Caesars. They're so clever and so powerful, the Flavians. And the founder Vespasian had 2 sons, and the older son Titus was the one in charge of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, the city of David. David's palatial, just below the temple. Then again, that barbell of complexity. The younger son's name was Domitian, and he made sure to poison the older brother, Titus, who only reigned for 2 years, because his lady fair was Jewish. Domitian took umbrage against the tutor of Saint John, who was Mary Magdalene, and he built a temple to himself in Ephesus, right next to the ancient center of the whole cult of Artemis and her long 900-foot-long temple in Ephesus. And this is the face on the colossal statue of Domitian in Ephesus, meant to silence forever the influence of Saint John and his tutor and the whole development. And this is the arm, only the head and the arm of Domitian survive. The arm is over 6 feet tall. He exiled St. John to the rocky island of Patmos off the coast of Asia Minor, thinking he was unable to bring death to St. John in Rome, and it's there on Patmos, that final death in life, exile, that he wrote the Apocalypse. But at the same time that he was writing the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, the fruition of that Greek language that he had pioneered, along with another confrère named Apollos in Alexandria, together for about 12 years after they laid Mary Magdalene to rest. They don't say she died. The Greek word is komesis. That whole quality was brought back into light in the late 190s, early 200s AD by a genius woman named Julia Domna, who married an African Roman emperor, Septimius Severus. He was masterful at being able to be complexly victorious in the kind of plotting that it took in Rome, but he had the African insight that all of this was a game of masks and that he was never confusing himself with the actuality that needed to be done. And so he was a very effective ruler, and his home city of Leptis Magna was so disregarded that it became a Roman equivalent with the Egyptian Amarna. Akhenaten, the husband of Nefertiti, and their whole center was forgotten, so was Leptis Magna. The way in which the sculptural frieze shows Julia Domna, she's holding up the caduceus, because she and Septimius Severus, this is her in detail, co-opted all of the wisdom literature of the Middle East, from Alexandria into Palestine, into everywhere that the Roman Empire could, and they took all the books and destroyed all the copies, so that wisdom was severely truncated and left in the hands of just a few. And when we start next week in 2015, we will take that presence and evaporate the present as a now that divides future and past, where our presence restores the continuity of the future and the new past, a symmetry that resonates into a harmonic. More than. Bye.